welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, foreign correspondent for NPR and former Alaska News Nightly host, Corey Flintoff. He joined APRN's Lori Townsend for an onstage conversation as part of the APRN Speaker Series, recorded at the Anchorage Museum on May 24th.
Good evening. My name is Steve Lindbeck. I'm the CEO of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, and we operate KAKM Channel 7, KSKA FM Radio, and the Alaska Public Radio Network. And I'm very delighted to welcome a nice crowd this evening to the APRN Speaker Series event featuring Corey Flintoff, who I think many of you know. He's one of our own. So before we introduce our panelists tonight, I'd like to recognize just a few people in the crowd who, with the lights now, I cannot see. But I wanted to welcome Carl Berger, who is the co-chair of the Alaska Public Broadcasting Commission, here from Bethel and travels abroad this week. Welcome, Carl. And Diane Feegis, who has served for the past 2 years as chair of the board of APTI and has done a fabulous job. I want to say publicly thank you to her. She was formally relieved of duty at a board meeting this evening. There's a new chair coming in, but Diane has done a wonderful job. And also Susan Fison, who is on the board of directors of APTI, who is somewhere out there, but I can't see in the glare. Susan, I'll take your word for it. Anyway, the APRN Speaker Series is a terrific event that we've created over the past 2 years. This is a benefit. Thank you for your support for the Alaska Public Radio Network. We have gradually, I call it sort of built the tribe. We've attracted many people who appreciate and take part in the work of public broadcasting in Alaska, and especially the Alaska Public Broadcast, Alaska Public Radio Network. And as you know, it has a distinguished history. And our key speaker tonight is a kind alumni of the APRN. And we think of it as one that we're very pleased to listen to his work on NPR and to reflect on his start in Alaska. So let me just read this bio. I rarely read these things fully, but this one's so compelling, I'm just gonna go for it here. Corey Flintoff is a foreign correspondent for NPR. His journalism career has taken him to more than 50 countries, most recently to Egypt to cover the civil war in Libya, the revolution in Egypt, and the war in Afghanistan. He was recently based in New Delhi, India, and they've got him back at home base in DC now for his current posting. After joining NPR in 1990, Flintoff worked for many years as a newscaster during All Things Considered. In 2005, he became part of the NPR team covering the Iraq War, where he embedded with U.S. military units fighting insurgents and hunting roadside bombs. Flintoff's reporting from Iraq includes stories on sectarian killings, government corruption, the Christian refugee crisis, and the destruction of Iraq's southern marshes. In 2010, he traveled to Haiti to report on the massive earthquake and its aftermath. 2 years before, he reported on his stint on a French warship chasing pirates off the coast of Somalia. There really are foreign correspondents still in the world. One of Corey's favorite side jobs at NPR is standing in for Carl Kasell during those rare times when the venerable scorekeeper takes a break from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And I just can't resist taking a moment now to let you know that Carl Kasell will be coming to Anchorage in July as the next in the APRN Speaker Series. So before his time at NPR, Corey Flintoff served as the executive producer and host of Alaska News Nightly, which is, of course, the daily news magazine produced by APRN from Anchorage. His coverage of the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill was recognized with the 1989 Corporation for Public Broadcasting Award. He got his start in 1977 got his start in public radio working at KYUK AM radio and television in Bethel. These aren't everywhere, but KYUK is a bilingual English and Yupik station. Corey learned just enough Yupik to announce the station identification. Appropriate for a kid who grew up in Fairbanks, I think. He wrote and produced a number of television documentaries about Alaska life, including They Never Asked Our Fathers and Eyes of the Spirit, which have aired on PBS and are now in the collection at the Smithsonian Institution. He tried his hand at commercial herring fishing, dog mushing, fiction writing, and other pursuits, but failed to break out of the radio business. Let me also introduce a person who's very important to our operations at APRN, Lori Townsend. Lori is the news director of the Alaska Public Radio Network now. She is beloved across the state for her leadership in that organization. She came to Alaska after working as a freelancer. She came in 1999, working at Koahnic Broadcasting. In 2000, she helped found the Native Voice Communications. And in 2003, APRN recruited her away from anything else she was doing, and we've been thrilled to have her ever since. She began her journalism career at WOJB, a tribal and NPR station in northern Wisconsin. She loves to garden. She has raised horses most of her life. She was once a welder, and she's a certified scuba diver. Lori will be interviewing Corey this evening, and I hope you'll enjoy the show.
Well, I would like to say thank you first, Steve, for that great introduction. And to Corey, I would like to say welcome home. It's great to have you. And I think it would be great to have you start out by talking to us about the early days in your career within public broadcasting. Before we launch into that, I did want to mention that today is my mom and dad's birthday. Both their birthday was on the same day, and they're both gone, but they would have really enjoyed this evening. So this is really an honor to be here with you on my mom and dad's birthday.
Oh, happy birthday to
them. So tell us about how you went from growing up in Fairbanks to KYUK in Bethel.
Yeah, in 1977, well, as a matter of fact, I grew up in Fairbanks, but I went to high school in San Francisco, and I went to San Francisco State College, and I couldn't get into a good university.
I was in the Navy for a couple of years, and then I went to Berkeley. I was at Berkeley right about the time of the Cambodia riots and People's Park. And so I was able to graduate, despite my lack of academic qualification, because there was so much chaos and confusion going on at the time that we didn't even go to our graduation. You know, and I never picked up my diploma from Berkeley because we were on strike. But at the same time, I never received the grades that I really deserved in my senior year, so I was able to graduate. I wound up in Chicago, where I met and married a young woman who was in dental school at the time. And she paid for her dental school with loans from the Indian Health Service, which meant that you had to go spend a couple of years working at an Indian Health Service hospital. And I said, well, let's go to Alaska. I mean, that's the perfect answer. And she said, well, I went into the office and I applied for this position, and there was something in Ketchikan and something in this place called Bethel. And I said, well, I've never been to Bethel, but I've heard that Ketchikan is really, really pretty. So why don't we go there? And she went into the office again. She came back the next day and she said, well, there's a little bit of delay about getting to Ketchikan, so I took Bethel. So I thought, oh God. and it bore out. We got to Bethel, and it was one of those days, you know, when it was just really cold and rainy. It was in July. And, but it was cold and it was rainy and it was really bleak. And we drove in, you know, from the airport to the old hospital there, and we couldn't look at each other. We thought, oh God, you know. But the very next day, I was sitting in the Indian Health Service Hospital in Bethel, and I talked to George Brenneman, who is still pretty well known in Alaska. I think he was a great pediatrician. And I said, well, what do you do for a job here? And because my real reason for going there was I thought, you know, well, my wife is working. I will do what I've always wanted to do, which was write the great American novel. And I thought, you know, long nights and everything, you know, you kind of can't go wrong. I could just be cranking away on this thing. And so I asked this doctor, you know, well, what do you do for part-time jobs? And he said, well, go over to the radio station. They always need somebody. And I did. And it turned out that, you know, that I always tell people in the States that you had to be able to say the station ID in Yupik, which is actually not true, but it makes a more colorful story. And then I whip out with my party trick, which is sort of the only Yupik that I know and have ever been able to retain, which is giving the station ID, which is Ni chugni uchi ni chugni sukun ke wa yu kemuk mani mam tlechme. See? Carl nodded approvingly, so I can still do it. But anyway, so that's how I got into public radio, and that's how I got my start. Qualifications were not required.
I love those stories. If you ask so many people in public broadcasting, especially people who have been there for a long time, some of the stories are so hilarious. Mm-hmm. I was at a conference once where people said, well, I was walking down this hallway and I went in the wrong doorway, and now I've been there for 22 years, and sort of that sort of thing. And from how many years were you at KYUK before you came to APRN?
I was at KYUK for about three and a half years, and I came back to Anchorage and worked for KSKA for about a year. Actually, I applied for two jobs when I first got here, and one of them was for the Alaska court system, because they needed somebody to help manage the rural magistrate training program. And it was a great job, paid $25,000 a year, and it was a state job. And so I thought, that's got to be it. You know, this will get me out of radio. That was one of my first real attempts. And the other job I applied for was at KSKA. And I really liked the KSKA job much better, but I thought that I'm supposed to be a grown-up now and I need to do something sensible, so I'll apply for this state job. And it turned out that they were so inefficient. I mean, state employment has not changed a bit as far as I can tell. They were so inefficient that it took them forever to make a decision. And when they finally did, I was so fed up with the process that I told them I didn't want the job anymore. And I went to work for KSKA. And I wish I could say that I've never looked back, but I've looked back frequently and thought, you know, I could have a pension from the state of Alaska.
And at KSKA, were you then recruited to APRN, or was that all, how did that work?
No, I only worked for KSKA for about a year, and it was very much like the Bethel job in that I didn't know anything about the, I was among other things, a classical music announcer, and I knew nothing about classical music, but I found out that you can easily read the backs of the album covers. And if you can get somebody like Beattie Trantina to coach you in how to say the names, it sounds just like you're a real announcer. So I did that for about a year. And then Carol Schatz, who was the station manager in Bethel, called me up and said, listen, I've got this scheme to do these video documentaries, and I think I can get money for it. So why don't you come back out and do that? And so I went back out to Bethel for another 3 years, and we did these really fun documentaries about Mukuriuk and Nunavak Island and Yupik dance. I think the foundations of the Chamay Festival and everything came about, you know, because we finally got the money and the chance to do things about Yupik culture. You know, so that was fun, and that was great. And then about 3 years later, so I had now spent about 7 years in Bethel, a job came open, the executive producer job came open at APRN. And it happened that I was on the board of APRN, which, you know, didn't strike me as a conflict of interest. So I applied for the job, and I actually got it.
Surprising.
The person who was the real candidate was Steve Heimel, who's right back there. He's the guy who should have gotten that job, but fortunately the fact that I had been on the board and I had a certain amount of influence got me the job. And I had the wit to know that I knew nothing about this job either. And so the first thing that I did was invite Steve over to the office, which was a bar on Northern Lights, and beg him to become, you know, to take the sort of deputy news director job there, which he did. You know, I mean, his standards were better than mine, but, you know, they weren't that much better. So he took the job. And thereon, he was able to mentor me through my entire career as the producer and host of Alaska News Nightly.
And that was in the days of reel-to-reel tape and razor mm-hmm. blades, which I came into public broadcasting on the tail end of that, which I'm very happy about. And so even though we're still working really hard, it's so much easier, as you well know, mm-hmm. with digital editing now. How in the world did you do a statewide newscast with reel tape on a daily deadline? I'm trying to wrap my head around that.
Well, as you could imagine, you know, because you're cutting actual vinyl reel-to-reel tape, and the opportunities to make mistakes are multiplied. You know, it's just incredible. And, I mean, we made fabulous mistakes on the air, because we'd always, you know, once you've cut off a piece of tape, and you usually hang it around your neck, you know, and if you're a well-organized person with a good memory, you remember what that piece of tape was. But if you're me, you put it in somewhere in the reel of tape, and you don't know what it was. So I remember once I was introducing a story about Tony Knowles, and there was a piece of tape by Mr. T. Remember Mr. T, the guy with the mohawk? And I believe that his catchphrase at the time was, "I pity the fool." And so I introduced something by Tony Knowles, and sure enough, what came up was, "I pity the fool." So there was a lot of that.
Well, that reminds me of when you're on air live, and when something like that happens. I know one time I was on air, and my brain made a strange connection, and instead of saying King Salmon, I said King Solomon. And then, of course,
it's a nice literary sound to it.
Try to keep from bursting into laughter, which, of course, would be very, very bad in the middle of a newscast. And it was one of the worst times I had at keeping myself together. Were there times, especially after I Pity the Fool, mm-hmm. were you able to come back on air and maintain your...
I was able to, yes, absolutely, because I have an extremely short attention span and a very poor memory. So, yeah, I have been, and throughout my career as a newscaster, too, I've been able to make horrible blunders. You know, people quit newscasting, people quit live radio after a certain amount of time, if they can't stand, you know, the embarrassment of constantly making mistakes. Never bothered me.
That must be how I've lasted this long. Well, before we move on to national and international issues, did you have a chance to get out to Eklutna today? Was my understanding
yes.
you were going to go? Yes. You went with my friend Aaron Leggett?
Yes, absolutely. Before I left NPR, last week, I ran into one of the producers for Morning Edition, and she said, "You know, we're doing this series, and it's called A Walk Through a Cemetery or something like that. But it has a wittier name than that, but I just can't remember what it was. But anyway, it's all through the summer. They're going to do about once a week. They'll do, you know, a visit to a famous cemetery like New Orleans or whatever." And she said, "Well, if you can come up with one, please do, and we'll air it." So I thought Eklutna would be the perfect place to do it. And sure enough, we came up with Aaron Leggett, whose family comes from Eklutna, and who's, you know, as an expert on Native
history.
Very young, but very
knowledgeable about the history.
So we went out there today, and we went and we looked at the spirit houses and we did a nice little interview.
So you're bigfooting the reporters in Alaska now, Corey?
No, not.
And when you left Alaska for NPR, that was in 1990, is that right?
That was right after the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Well, it was actually the year after, yes, because you know how, you know how, every reporter's career has a disaster in it that helped them get up to their, you know, get a leg up to the next job. Dan Rather, for instance, you know, it was the Kennedy assassination. Mm-hmm. For me, it was the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And it was undeserved because I was kind of the host of Alaska News Nightly. I didn't do a terrible amount of reporting there, but I had a lot of contacts with the people at NPR, and they said, well, why don't you come out and do a couple of weeks of fill-in for us, and we'll see how you fit in. And the guy who was the executive producer of Morning Edition says, you're pretty good, kid. I think, you know, if you came out here, I have an overnight editor's job that I could give you, and you get a foot in the door. And I mean, can you imagine overnight editor is absolutely the worst job you can possibly get. You know, you never see daylight, you know, and it goes on, and nobody pays any attention to what you do. You know, so no matter how good you are, you never get any credit for it. So I got there, and I thought I was going to get this job, and I was all happy about it. And it turned out that he didn't ever intend to give me the job. He was using me as leverage for the guy that he really wanted to give the job to, so he could pay him less money. So it was, yeah.
Bad form.
You don't want to know that about your national public radio. But that's the way things were done then. So I didn't get the job, and I was momentarily depressed about it, but a friend of mine said, well, why don't you audition for a weekend newscaster? You know, it'll give you something to do until you find a real job. And so I did, and I got that job. And fortunately, then Frank Stacia, who was the All Things Considered on the hour newscaster, left shortly afterwards to do humanitarian work. So I took his job. And I was much better off. The guy who actually got that overnight editor's job is still doing it.
No.
I see him every once in a while, and he's very, very, very pale.
The perfect vampire position. Well, when I think of newscasters, I think of Carl Castle and Lakshmi Singh, Korva Coleman, names that we've known for quite a long time. Did you wake up one day and decide, you know, this is just too safe and too secure, I need to go somewhere and dodge bullets? What made you decide you wanted to go into foreign correspondent work?
Being a newscaster is sort of like dentistry. You know, you have to be really good to do it, but there's not an awful lot of difference, you know, from day to day, you know, from mouth to mouth. You know, so that's why, you notice dentists in Alaska always fly their own planes, you know, and do things like that. It's not enough to keep the mind alive. And the only thing going at the time was the Iraq War, you know, that you could get overseas with. Well, no, actually that's not true. Actually, I applied a couple of times to go do Iraq War coverage, and I never got those jobs. But I got to fill in for Michelle Kellerman, who's the State Department reporter. And I filled in for her for a while, and I didn't do a very good job at it, frankly, because I'm not really a good policy person. You know, there's really too much thinking involved. As a reporter, I'm more of a fire reporter. I like to go to the fire, see what the fire looks like, come back and tell you about it, you know. I'm not really good on, I wasn't good on State Department protocol. And I wasn't good at understanding, you know, the diplomatic issues that were involved. And so I think after the 5 months or so of Michelle's maternity leave, I would have left that job and never gotten another job with a foreign desk. But right at the very end, this was in 2006, And that was the year of one of the big Haitian presidential elections after Aristide was kicked out. And so it was a really violent time in Haiti and a really violent lead up to the election. And so I got to go there. And I got to go there for about 2.5 weeks, and I have never been so thrilled or so excited in my life. I had the time of my life there. And I did some of the best work that I had done in a long time because I was really having fun. And that was really go to the fire and look at the fire kind of reporting. And so that actually saved me. You know, after having done the Haitian coverage, my boss, the foreign editor, trusted me enough to give me an Iraq assignment. And that was the start of all that.
Did your work in Bethel and being in remote communities in Alaska, which is in some communities it's like nowhere else in the U.S., did that sort of help when you got to foreign assignments somehow?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And the way it helped was, and actually this was, people in Bethel are very thoughtful about this. In fact, when Carol Schatz was the station manager, we did a couple of things about cross-cultural communication and how, you know, Western outside reporters can interview Yupik people in a respectful way and in a way that makes sense. For instance, it does not make sense for a Yupik elder person if you ask them to predict the future. You know, I mean, that's a ridiculous question when you think about it. it's disrespectful to you look an elder person in the eye when you're interviewing them. You know, there are a lot of things that you have to learn about communicating with someone whose sort of cultural point of reference is very different from yours. And that, of course, is true the world round. You know, so that when you meet an Arab from Iraq, you know, you quickly discover that there are a set of you know, points of view that you have to learn to understand. And, you know, having watched the U.S. military operate in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, now for however many years, you realize how important that is, and that when you fail to do that, you fail to take that into consideration, you make horrible, horrible mistakes. So if I had not been in Bethel, and if I had not had the opportunity to find out what it's like to work in a cross-cultural environment, I would never have been able to do the work that I did in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And was there other training that you went through for foreign correspondent work, or was KYUK pretty much it?
well, I mean, all of Alaska is pretty much foreign correspondence, you know, so... No, I have not done. I had not done other kinds of foreign reporting. One thing that they do when you before you go to a conflict zone is they put you through a week of what they call hostile environment training, and you know you do a lot of first aid training, and they do mock up things where you're kidnapped by you know ransom holders and that sort of thing, and it's very exciting, but it has nothing to do with what you. Eventually end up doing, you know, when you're reporting in conflict zones, because you simply can't predict that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that work, that foreign work that you've done. Egypt has, today was their second day of voting in their first election in how long? Hosni Mubarak is a name that I certainly grew up hearing, and he had a cozy relationship with the United States and got ousted, and now they have this election process going on. The reporting today said that it seems fairly orderly, but there's, of course, accusations of fraud and mismanagement flying back and forth. What are your thoughts about how clean the process is or is not?
You know, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't think that they have, I don't know whether they have international observers in any kind of force there or not, but I would not be surprised if the voting wasn't as clean as a whistle. You know, if those they weren't using the transparent plastic ballot boxes and you know election judges and all the rest of it, I was just in Russia, you know, for the Russian elections, and they did that, you know, so that when you went from polling place, the election looked really nice. But what happens is that those elections are pre-manipulated It doesn't matter how clean it is when you're actually at the balloting place. It's what's happened in Egypt is that the military has manipulated who the candidates are. So they have absolutely controlled the outcome before the voting ever starts. And I think that's a real tragedy. Because when we were there in, this would be in January, in February, you know, when the Arab Spring broke out, I felt like there was real reason for optimism about it. You know, I mean, there's a wonderful Egyptian middle class, you know, people who are very thoughtful and have a very cosmopolitan outlook and really understand. Most of them have traveled abroad. Most of them know what democracy looks like in Western Europe, at least. You know, and that's what they wanted for their country. And I really thought when I left the first time at the end of February that was going to happen. I felt really quite optimistic. And I think that revolution has been stolen.
Hmm. What do you think will mean for the country if the Muslim Brotherhood prevails and takes the election? What will that mean?
I think that it's not going to make an awful lot of difference. I actually interviewed people from the Muslim Brotherhood there, and they're not so very different from evangelical Christians. I'm seriously, you know? I mean, they want a strictly religious society. They want a society that's very socially conservative. They're, you know, in the same sense that evangelical Christians want to control the sort of mores of, you know, the American public and do it, you know, by democratic means, you know, by making laws. That's what the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt wants. You know, I'd say they're no more fundamentalist than we are in a lot of respects. But it really doesn't matter because the military is still in control of what happens in Egypt. And I don't think that, you know, the party labels of whoever gets elected are going to make any difference.
How is it for the Christians that live there? I understand about 10% of the population is Christian.
Yeah, and it's terrible. It's terrible. We did a number of stories with Christians in Alexandria, you know, which is, you know, real center of Coptic Christian life, and people there were terrified. They really felt that. I mean, one of the things that that Hosni Mubarak maintained was this certain amount of protection for religious minorities. In part, they say because he wanted to maintain a divided society. And it was fine to have a middle class of Coptic Christians, you know, who would be your mercantile class and your doctors and lawyers and dentists and so forth, you know, highly educated people, you know, as long as they supported the regime. But as soon as that protection was taken away, a lot of fundamentalism that makes its way to Egypt through Saudi Arabia, you know, through the border with Saudi Arabia around Suez, takes over, you know, the sort of thuggery that that involves takes over, and that's why there's been so much persecution of Christians, you know, and burning of churches and that sort of thing. So yeah, things are not good for Christians in Egypt, and I don't think they're going to get better.
Do you think the Egyptian people as a whole are worse off or better off than they were under Mubarak's rule?
I don't think I can answer that question. I wish I could say that they're better off, you know, or at least, you know, we know that economically they're worse off at the moment. You know, I mean, a lot of studies have shown that the economy is quite a bit worse than it was. Tourist economy has absolutely been blasted, you know, I mean, people are afraid to go there now. So economically they're worse off, but I think politically they're no better off. So, you know, that makes a wash on the negative side.
Libya is a country that also went through a big transformation, civil war, and another name that I grew up knowing, Muammar Gaddafi, is now gone. And now I was reading today that the UK is working with a delegation to try to organize clean elections there sometime within this next year in Tripoli. What do you see unfolding there, and how do you think that process will go?
I think the problem in Libya is that You know, there are a lot of people from the old regime who are still in the government, but I don't think that they're embedded in the way that the Egyptian military is. So, I mean, I think they do have to answer for a certain amount of democratic impulse from the population. But I think the trouble in Libya is that Gaddafi, you know, in Egypt you have a strong man. The strong man manages to keep factionalism and sectarianism under control. This is true in Iraq as well. And Gaddafi was the same way. He exploited sectarianism for his own purposes, but at the same time he also managed to keep violence down. And the problem in Libya is tribalism and regionalism. And what we're seeing, even when we were first there, was that the regional militias from places like Misrata and Zintan were already exerting way too much power in Tripoli. You know, I mean, they're incredibly heavily armed because they raided the armories that Gaddafi had set up. So they have no end of weapons. They have a tribal system that makes people loyal to their tribal leaders and not to whoever the elected officials may be. And they're like gangs. They're like armed gangs now. You know, and so unless Libya figures out a way to deal with that kind of these militias and power structures, I don't think things are gonna come out well.
What are the comparisons between the two revolutions in Egypt and Libya? How do these two big events compare with each other?
Egypt, a much larger educated class, people who are well wired in, you know, with the truism that it was social media that created the Egyptian revolution, and that's true. You know, I mean, people really are media savvy, or there's a whole layer of young people who are very media savvy, and they were able to use that, you know, to circumvent all the government censorship and repression. And that was not true in Libya. There actually is quite a strong educated class, but the Gaddafi family maintained control of all the communications in the country. And so, for instance, when we were there, we couldn't make a phone call to a source in Tripoli because the fear was that, you know, your phones would be tapped. You absolutely couldn't use your, even use email to contact people because all that was being tapped as well. I should say that I was actually in Libya twice. I was there once when Gaddafi was still in power, and then once again after, you know, the rebels had taken over Tripoli. So the time that I was there, that Gaddafi was still in power, all the foreign correspondents were put in one hotel where we were supposedly kept under wraps, and we would only see what the government wanted us to see. They would wake you up in the middle of the night and take you to a hospital to show you people who had been injured by the NATO bombing, for instance. But they'd also take us out to villages where they thought they were going to show you something that was an atrocity committed by NATO, and they'd wind up actually showing you a place where anti-Gaddafi graffiti had been painted over on the walls, and so clumsily that you could actually still read it. You know, so, you know, it's really a failure. You know, if I ever got myself a consulting job, you know, consulting with some dictator, I would tell them, don't let the foreign media in. Absolutely not, because there's just no way. There's no way you can keep them from seeing stuff. And we actually went out. We were not supposed to leave this. It's called the Rixos Hotel, and it's kind of notorious now. They have guards, and we were not supposed to leave. The only way that you could leave this hotel was to go to the little store across the street to buy, you know, sodas and cigarettes and things like that. And then you were supposed to come right back. But we would go over to the store, and then we'd just keep walking until you found a cab, and then get the cab to take you to one of the neighborhoods in Tripoli that you knew were sort of hotbeds of revolutionary activity. And once you got there, you would sort of walk down the street from one store to another until you found somebody who would talk to you. And it didn't take very long at all before somebody would walk up. And I was just with my producer, it was a young woman, I was about 26, named Susanna George, who actually speaks a little Arabic. And sure enough, guy walks up to her, slips a little piece of paper into her hand, and it was his phone number. And so we called him, and at great risk to him, because, you know, our phones might not have been tapped, but his almost certainly was. Mm-hmm. You know, and we arranged to meet him. We did the trick of going to the store, and I don't know why the guards at the hotel never got wise to this, that it would take us 2 or 3 hours, you know, to go buy cigarettes or whatever to come back. But they didn't. And so we got another taxi, and we went to this part of town that was sort of notorious, and we went to the pharmacy and sort of waited for this guy. And he shows up, and he's got the hat pulled down over his eyes and the dark glasses. You know, it's like he was the only guy who had the hat pulled down and the dark glasses. You know. So no way you're going to know this. The guy was doing anything suspicious. Puts us in his car, makes us get down, you know, in the back of the car, you know, and drives us through a whole bunch of back streets and everything. And with these things, you never know who you're with. You know, you get into a car with a stranger in a town like that, and it could be the secret police or something. And, you know, but it turned out he was actually a security guy. He did work for the secret police, but he was a rebel sympathizer. And he took us to his house. They gave us tea. And we did a great interview with this guy. And he was talking about the resistance in his neighborhood and how they fought with the police every night in this neighborhood. And it was something that the Gaddafi public relations people were really anxious to keep quiet about. And they're really anxious to show us pro-Gaddafi demonstrations, and that kind of thing. So these people, with incredible courage, mm-hmm. you know, because if you get caught, if your phone is tapped and they find out who you are, and especially if they find out that you're one of them, you know, if you're in the secret police, I'm sure that he would have been arrested and tortured to death. And the unfortunate thing is I never found out whether he was caught or not, because when we were supposed to meet him a second time, and he was going to introduce us to other people in the neighborhood who were part of this network, and we could never reach him. We were calling him on a Thuraya satellite phone, because the beauty of that, at least, is when the number shows up on your phone, you can't tell where it's coming from. You know, so it wasn't traceable in that sense. But we were never able to reach him. We were never able to get back through to him. And when I came back the second time after the rebels had taken over Tripoli, I couldn't find him. Mm. You know, and we asked, and we wandered around this neighborhood where we had met him, and we couldn't find any trace of him. So I'm afraid that because this guy was courageous enough to speak out, he may have been swept up.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Corey Flintoff, foreign correspondent for NPR and former host of Alaska News Nightly on APRN. Corey joined APRN's Lori Townsend for an onstage conversation at the Anchorage Museum as part of the APRN Speaker Series on May 24th.
Extremely dangerous work. And when you are moving around like that, how, your wife is here, how do you keep her from being tremendously upset and worried when you're out on these assignments and doing this type of work where you could have been swept up and taken somewhere and killed just as easily?
Well, we don't have, we didn't have very good communication.
That's probably not very reassuring.
We talk about it. We talk about it. It's not like I tell her everything's fine, you know. And what she asks is that I just exercise reasonable caution, not that I not do things. And all she says is, do good work, you know. So, but then she's a radio person, so that's, you know, she
wants
knows.
To hear those stories.
Yeah.
You also have, in addition to working alone, you've also embedded. What mm-hmm. are your thoughts about reporters embedding with the military?
I just did a speech about this at Quantico about 2 weeks ago at the Marine University there, because a guy whose unit I embedded with, he's a lieutenant colonel in the Marines. We were in Marja in southern Afghanistan, And I was embedded with his unit twice, actually. And so he put together a program for American officers and foreign officers who were taking a class in, I guess, in dealing with reporters. And so they invited a panel of us. And the reason I went, I would have squirmed out of this because I, you know, it just seemed like too much work. But one of the other people who was on the panel was Geraldo. And I thought, God, I can't miss a chance to be on a panel with Geraldo. And so I went. And of course, what it was about was, you know, whether it's moral and decent to be embedded. And, you know, I mean, as you know, I mean, the debate among journalists is quite reasonable. I mean, because you know that when you're embedded with the American military, it's not that you see what they want you to see. It's that you see what they see. I mean, and if you get the difference, you know, when you're in a Humvee or an MRAP or something like that, and you look out the window, everything out there looks scary. You know, we're driving through Baghdad in a Humvee, and you look out there and you see a car coming in the other direction. You're thinking car bomb. You see a little pile of trash by the side of the road, you're thinking IED. Mm. You see a guy with a cell phone on a street corner, you're thinking, this guy's gonna blow me up. Mm. Whereas if you're in a civilian car in Baghdad driving through the very same neighborhood, it looks like a neighborhood, you know, and you feel quite secure there. You know, so that's one of the most valuable things about embedding with the military, I think, is that when you're among people who are actively engaged in the conflict, you have to be really careful because you're going to start thinking like, you know, you're going to start thinking like a uniformed person, you know, who has his finger on a trigger, you know. So it's very important to constantly remind yourself, I'm in this very narrow view of the war. I'm seeing, you know, a very restricted view of it, and you have to tell the people that when you do the stories, you have to say, this is a very restricted view of the war. This is not what's happening. This is what, you know, somebody in the 3-6 Marines happens to see at any given time. And I think if you can do that, I think then there's value in embedding. But if not, you become like Geraldo, who got up in front of the same crowd that I was in front of and said, you know, I'm really not objective about this at all. I love the military. And I think that everything you're doing right now is great. And I think last time I was in Afghanistan, it was clear to me that we were winning and that we were gonna win. This is 2 weeks ago, he said that. So, Geraldo is a really charming guy in person. No, I mean, he's a really nice guy, really sort of self-deprecating character. You know, I mean, he's not an egomaniac, you know, the way he appears on television. But, I mean, he really does believe that. I mean, and he, you know, what you see is what you get. He's not making it up. He really believes that stuff.
That's kind of incredible, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the ambassador to Afghanistan and also Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, Ryan Crocker just stepped down. What do you think that means for relations with the U.S. and these countries?
I think that, you know, that's probably admission that, you know, things are not going to get any better in Afghanistan, and the sooner we get out, the better. I mean, Ryan Crocker presided over the end of the war in Iraq, and he is a very steely kind of American diplomat. You know, I mean, he really does the job, you know, and he really talks the line. And one of the reasons why they give him these jobs is that he is able to be a very tough talker with the, you know, the first the Iraqi government and then the Afghan government. And my guess is that the reason why he's leaving is that no amount of tough talk will work anymore. You can't tell Karzai what to do. Because Karzai knows we're leaving, you know, and all he wants to ensure is that there's going to be enough money flowing for the next few years so that he can secure himself his capital, and that's all he really, they, you know, they call Karzai the mayor of Kabul because that's all he controls, really. So unfortunately, I think the fact that Crocker is going is a sign that, you know, we're not going to get anywhere with these people, and the sooner we get out, the better.
And in Pakistan now, they've sentenced the doctor who helped the CIA to 33 years. It seems like Pakistan sort of has this high school relationship with the U.S. where it's hot and cold quite often. What's unfolding there in your estimation?
I think the same thing. You know, I was offered the job. I was offered the Islamabad bureau because the person who, Julie McCarthy, who's the correspondent, has been the correspondent there for 3 years, has just finished up her tour. And so they were looking for somebody to do this. And to me, it seemed like one of the most intractable relationships. You know, when I went to fill in there for a couple of weeks, it was after this killing had taken place on the border where Americans killed 24 Pakistani soldiers. And that's when they closed the border. That border traffic, you know, where they bring up NATO supplies from Karachi to Afghanistan over this long road, is one of the most profitable things in Afghanistan. It's one of their only resources, in a way, was the money that they were getting from NATO. And yet they were willing to shut it down for 6 months at cost of billions and billions of dollars, not just in legitimate payments, but in bribes and, you know, black market money, potential for stealing things from the convoys. They gave up all that because they didn't want to be humiliated in their relationship with the United States. And I think that's something that we've never taken into account. We've always assumed that we can do business with these people without having a respectful relationship or without having not a diplomatic relationship. We have a diplomatic relationship, but Americans think we can always do business, you know? And in places like Pakistan, you can't. Places like Pakistan, you have to have an emotional relationship with people. You have to have a respectful cultural relationship. And you have to have a shared purpose. And I don't think we have any of those things with people in Pakistan. So, you know, they were willing to bleed themselves from billions of dollars because they didn't want to be humiliated. And, you know, that's why I think, you know, the sooner we're out of there, the better, too.
Do you think it works for us to try to tell people that democracy is good for them? Do they want that? They have such a different style and have for generations of governance. Does it work?
No, and I don't think it's because it's not that cliche, you know, that, for instance, the Islamic world is not ready for democracy or that it will never be democratic. I don't think that's true. I just think that people's notions about democracy are really different. You know, and if you know, maybe the reason it works in America is because we always had this kind of, you know, English common law and sort of church meeting democracy, you know, elected Presbyterian elections and that sort of thing. So it's kind of ingrained, but, you know, people's notions, for instance, in Egypt or in Libya, people told me that they didn't believe in democracy at all and that they thought it was really a fallacious way to run people's lives, you know, that there had to be a strong leader. And that leader could not, if that leader had to rely on elections, then he'd become a panderer like all the Western European and American leaders, you know. You know, so, and there's a kind of logic to that, obviously, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's not that they can't do it, it's just that their notion of what it is really different. And I think that going, you know, I think that what's effective is what, a lot of the NGOs do, you know, that rule of law NGOs and things like that. that if you do it at the grassroots level and you talk to people about rule of law, or you talk to people about effective elections and effective local governance and things like that, little by little, I think that that has an effect. But if you try to do it top down, you know, by working from the existing government structures, I don't think it'll ever work.
Well, I have lots of other questions that I'd love to get to, but I also want to allow time for other people to ask questions. And so I only have two more that I want to make sure to get in. One is, I understand that you have expertise in Elizabethan literature, and has that helped in your news writing?
Yeah. When I got a master's in Renaissance drama, and the thing that really drew it to me, I don't know if anybody here, you know, it wasn't so much Shakespeare as the revenge tragedies. Is anybody like the Duchess of Malfi and the White Devils? These are pretty obscure Renaissance plays, but they're like opera plots. They're all about violence and sex and violence, you know. So there's been a tradition of this kind of stuff, and I always really liked it. So, since we've had much more violent television than we used to, you know, some of that, you know, the need for that has gone away. But but I do find myself, when I do stories overseas, I do look, I think of them as dramas. So when you do a story, obviously you have to work with facts, which is a little inconvenient. But what you do is, and this happened with this guy, in the Marine colonel who invited me to Quantico. We were in Marja, and I don't know if you remember that there was a big offensive in Marja because the Taliban were, it was one of the places where the Taliban had been in control almost since the start of the war, and they were running a very profitable opium growing business there. And so they send in these Marines, and in the course of about 2 weeks of actually very hard fighting, they managed to drive the Taliban not out but underground, and so they maintained this very tenuous control over the area. Although within a week of the time they got there, the Taliban were already sending around night letters to everyone who cooperated with the Americans in any respect, including answering simple questions of them, a letter at night saying, "We're going to kill you." So in fact, this is just surface control of this area. And one of the things that, you know, once the, this is COIN strategy, you know, counterintelligence strategy, and it was the big thing that, what's his name? The guy who's running the CIA now. Yeah. Anyway, that was his big thing, was counterinsurgency strategy. And of course, what you do is when you conquer a place militarily, and then you build up the infrastructure there and carry out projects to show people how good your intentions are and how you are really better than the Taliban. And so the thing that they wanted the Marines to do was not just to capture this place and hold it, but to create infrastructure. And the thing that this guy, and he was a lieutenant, young lieutenant colonel, his name was Brian Christmas. And the thing that Colonel Christmas was supposed to do was build a school. So I did a story about him. He would go around to these local councils. You know, this is where all these guys who look exactly like they come from the first Afghan War, which took place in 1841. They look exactly the same. You know, they have the big turbans and the long red beards, and they look exactly the same. And in fact, I have some photographs of Colonel Christmas talking to groups of these guys, and he looks eerily like the young British soldier standing up there, you know, saying, "We've brought you the benefits of Queen and country." Mm. And so he would hold these meetings, which are called shuras, with the village elders, and he'd say, "Listen, you know, the first thing I want to do is get a school established here, because I know the Taliban kept your kids from going to school, and you know, this will be the first benefit of the Americans being here. So just tell me where you want the school to go, and show me the person who's going to be the teacher, and we'll get you going. I'll have my engineers in here. We'll build your school in no time. And we went out and we did these meetings, you know, every day or every couple of days, and you know, they'd all say, "Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, we want to do that. Of course, we want to have a school for our kids. Absolutely." And they did sort of bring this guy who was actually a motorcycle mechanic forward, you know, sort of a young guy, and shoved him into the center and said, "Well, he'll be our teacher." And he had no qualifications, but you know, coming from where I'm coming from, I didn't have any problems with that. But the thing was that we never got anywhere with this project. You know, Brian Christmas finally said, "You know, put up or shut up. You know, show me where you want me to build the school, and we'll do it. But otherwise, you know, I can't keep coming around and talking to you every day and not getting anywhere." And that's when somebody finally stood up and said, "The Taliban will kill us if we build a school, and they might bomb us, and they might kill all our children too." You know, and how do we know that we can trust you to protect us once you've built the school? You know, because our experience with you is that you come here and you capture territory and you stay for a while and then you go away. And then everybody who cooperated with you gets their throat cut. So, you know, suddenly everything became clear. And we realized why no amount of good intentions and American energy and resourcefulness and, you know, optimism was going to help the situation. You know, and Brian Christmas actually did finally build a school on his own, and kids came to it for a while, and I understand that as soon as he left and he was replaced by another Marine unit, the whole thing just fizzled. So I forget what the point of that story was.
Well, we were talking about your background in literature, and somehow
so I guess
it's all linked to school.
So there was a narrative arc. Narrative arc was what this story was about.
Right.
Brian Christmas was my character, and the conflict was how do we build a school in the conflict zone, and you know, the village elders were the chorus, and you know, the villains were off stage, but they were definitely there, and you know, the end of that story basically had Brian Christmas walking away from that last council meeting and, you know, leaving everybody with a sort of depressing consequence of what was happening there.
Well, before we let other folks ask questions, I wondered if you had any good Steve Heimel stories you could share with us.
No. I just sort of got a message, you know, that I should say no. No, actually, I sort of told my good Steve Heimel story, which is he did save me when I came to work for APRN by showing me how to do news and reporting and stuff. And because I, you know, I worked in Bethel all this time and I'd done a lot of stories, but I hadn't exactly done news and reporting and journalism. And so he showed me, and also showed me how to do radio. You know, actually, that was kind of my salvation there. He was never very nice about it. But he's sort of known for that. And subsequently, he's trained an awful lot of people at APRN, you know, who came away being sort of proud of the fact that Steve Heimel was not very nice to them. You know, and they really felt that it had done them some good. You know, so that's kind of my story about Steve Heimel.
Well, thank you so much. I've really had a great time, and do we have questions out here? Yes.
Well, I would say the point about Colonel Christmas is that he invited you to Quantico so that you could tell his colleagues what it was like, as opposed to what Geraldo was going to say. But, Peter Kenyon told us that NPR has more foreign correspondents than somebody, and I wonder if you have a story or two about some of the other foreign correspondents
you've
met on these journeys?
Yeah. Let me think about that. Let me think about what the end of the story is going to be before I start it out. I've had the opportunity to work with some really, really good people, and among them, you know, are people who've recently, I'll just talk about the people who've won Peabody's lately. You know, first it was Saraya Sarhadi Nelson from Kabul, from Afghanistan, you know, who worked in Afghanistan for 3 years at the time when things were the most violent and the worst there. Saraya has the advantage of the fact that she's half Persian and half German. So she's sort of, unlike most of the Persians that I met in Afghanistan, she gets places on time. But she speaks, you know, people in Afghanistan, especially in northern Afghanistan, speak Dari, which is a version of Farsi. And so she speaks the language, basically, and she looks like a person who comes from there. And so, you know, she had incredible access, but she also had tremendous courage. And she was part of that march of coverage as well. And one of the things, I think you can actually find this story on the website, she was with the unit when one of their people was killed. And you actually hear it on air. A lot of people didn't realize what they were hearing, but it was one of these classic stories where you hear a lot of gunfire, and you hear Saraya laying on the ground behind a little mud wall about that high, and you can hear that eerie, whistly sound of bullets going overhead, and then you hear a cry, like somebody being hit, and that was a young Navajo guy that she had interviewed just the morning before. And had a just, it was kind of a nice little interview about, yeah, it's pretty scary out here, but I'm gonna see my family, you know, in a few more months. And she agreed to lend him her satellite phone so that he could call home. And he was supposed to make that call in the evening of the day he was killed. So Saraya had to actually maintain her composure while lying behind this mud brick wall, feeling having the bullets go overhead, and seeing somebody that she had looked in the eye and had a friendly conversation with killed before her very eyes. And she told me about this story afterwards. I mean, she told me what it was like to be there, and she cried. But she didn't cry when she was making the story. She didn't cry when she was recording it. And she didn't cry when she produced it up and sent it back to NPR and made us all understand a little better about what really was happening out there. You know, so that's colossal courage. Another person that I've worked with is Lourdes Garcia Navarro, who just got a, Saraya got a Peabody, incidentally, for 2 years ago. And she also got the Overseas Press Club Award, which is much more coveted, actually, because that's where your colleagues vote you the best overseas correspondent of the year. Lulu got both those awards the next year. And in her case, it was in Libya, because, while Gaddafi was still in power, people were slipping across the border from Tunisia with the rebel forces, and Lulu went along with them all the way through the mountains of Libya while the NATO bombing was going on in Tripoli, and these totally irregular, unmilitary, untrained militia people were making their way against Gaddafi's army, well-armed and well-trained army, at a time when, that's when it's really scary. It's not like being embedded with Americans, with the best military in the world. This is being embedded with the worst military in the world. You know, so you never know whether they're gonna shoot themselves, or you, or they're gonna blow something up, you know, or you, or whether they're going to be defeated by the opposing forces because they have so little training and, you know, so little preparation that you know, there's no protection for you at all. So Lulu made her way all the way through the Libyan Revolution and finally entered Tripoli with the victorious rebels. And I can't think of anything more dangerous or sort of more triumphant in the end than possibly the victory of Fidel Castro in Cuba, entering into Havana. You know, it must have been very much like that. And Lulu, who is Latin American and has a lot of affinity with the Cubans, thought so too.
Hi. We're visiting from Phoenix, Arizona, and we're just thrilled and so thankful that we had an opportunity to be here in Anchorage to see you in person at this wonderful event. I want to ask you about...
I'm way older than you thought, aren't I?
You're a lot older. Now we're going to switch to a different station. Just kidding. This question relates to another part of the Middle East, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I want to know if you've reported from there, and I'm kind of asking this because it's a question my daughter would want to ask. She's at American University in their graduate school program in D.C. on peace and conflict resolution. So she would want to ask you if there's any possibility to resolve the conflict through peaceful means, what your opinion might be on the Israeli-Palestinian situation.
Well, I told you how I am on foreign policy. The only time I reported from Jerusalem was actually on a State Department trip with Condoleezza Rice. And this was when Sharon was still healthy and was still negotiating, and things looked a lot more optimistic at the time. And even then, that was the reason that Condoleezza Rice was there, was to negotiate the reopening of the Rafah crossing into Gaza. It had been closed for quite some time, and it was before actually the latest Gaza war took place and all that. And that took 3 days of intense negotiating to get even that much done. And she walked away with what was thought to be a diplomatic victory because there was an agreement. No sooner had we moved on to the next stop, which I forget where it was, but we discovered that the agreement had fallen apart. And that's been my experience of everything that's happened with Israeli-Palestinian negotiations before and since. There are so many political forces at play, domestic politics for both the Israelis and the Palestinians, foreign politics from Egypt and the United States and Saudi Arabia and everybody who has a stake and a financial stake in that process, that I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime. But it's lucky that I'm way older than you thought I was.
Yes, sir.
Corey, what are the ethical implications of interviewing someone and placing them thereby in moral danger?
Well, to tell you the truth, I would not have done it if I had known better, if I had known what I know now. And I should have known because, that was just last year, and it's not like I just started doing this stuff. I've gotten into cars with a lot of other people who I didn't know and gone to places that I didn't know. But I have to say, actually, before I worked in Egypt and in Libya, I've never been in a full-out police state. Now, I take that back. I've been in Syria, but I never reported in a police state before, and I think I didn't understand the pervasiveness and the terror and the ruthlessness of the security apparatus in those places. And that's my only excuse, and that's not a good one. But I think if I had known the real danger that this guy was in, I would not have done it.
Other questions? Yes.
What view do the foreigners have of America and our whole political election process?
I'll bet anybody and all of you who travel abroad and people in Alaska travel abroad far more often, I think, than people in the rest of the country do. People around the world really like Americans. And in general terms, they really hate the American government. And it's this is not me saying bad things about the American government. It's just that people do not like to have their politics interfered with. And, you know, so anything that appears to be either economic or political interference naturally stirs up all this bitterness against us. But, I mean, I've met Taliban, you know, who thought I was a perfectly nice guy and treated me perfectly well, you know, because they don't dislike Americans. It's just, you know, what they perceive as American interference that they don't like.
Yes.
Great. I'm wondering if you're going to vote for Ron Paul, or if not, what do you think our foreign policy should be? I think you painted a picture that we seem to be failing on all fronts in terms of our efforts to make the world safe for democracy. Where do we go from here?
That's a good question. No, I'm not an isolationist. And in fact, I want to tell everybody here that I'm going to vote just exactly the way you would. But no, I'm not an isolationist. I really, it's not that I don't believe that the U.S. has agency, you know, in foreign affairs, and also that I believe the U.S. has responsibilities in foreign affairs. But, you know, I think it's been proven, you know, it should have been proven to us a long time ago, and I think it's been proven over and over again in the last decade or so that in general, military involvement isn't accomplishing our foreign policy goals. And I think we need to find other ways to do that. And I think American aid is an important way to do that. I don't think that nation building is a good idea, but I think democracy support is a good idea. I think health aid is a good idea. I don't think building infrastructure is a very good idea. I think that's something else that's proved out in the last couple of decades. You know, we spent a lot of money on infrastructure in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's been an absolute failure. So I don't think that's what it is. You know, what people like about Americans is our energy and our optimism and our friendliness and our generosity. You know, and American aid manages to do that when it's not done with some underlying nefarious purpose. You know, when American aid is given, you know, in the spirit of generosity that we give aid to our own domestic charities and so forth, people like us and admire us. And then people will cooperate with us and help us understand what it is that they really need and not what we think they need. So that's the kind of American involvement that I would advocate.
Corey, I'm going to selfishly squeeze one more question in before we take another one from the audience here. You're back in D.C. now, and we've been hearing about NPR's funding woes. What's the commitment that they have you heard about maintaining foreign desks? Are they going to be able to do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. We've heard, you know, that NPR is going to have to tighten its belt again. You know, that funding has gotten tighter all over. And, you know, it's primarily corporate funding, you know, and the fact that we could be facing the second dip of a recession or at least not recovering as quickly as we thought we were has not helped us in our corporate fundraising or even our foundation fundraising. So times are going to be a little tough, but we have heard from the new president, Gary Nill, that he's very committed to foreign reporting, and that is because, you know, so many other news organizations are withdrawing their foreign bureaus, and NPR actually has expanded. And it's a very important part of what we do, a very important part of the big flagship news programs is foreign reporting. So they have told us that they're committed to keeping all our 17 foreign bureaus open and staffed, and, you know, if the good Lord willing and the creek don't rise, we should be in fairly decent shape.
Do you see yourself going back?
Yes. Yeah, I'll tell you all, because I'm getting quite reckless about this. You know, you should never tell, you know, when you've applied for a job, because then you're embarrassed if you don't get it. I've applied for the Moscow Bureau to be the Moscow correspondent. And so you'll all know if I don't get it.
Yes.
On the news, you hear about the tribal areas and the tribal elders. How does that compare to ours here in Alaska? And what do you know about those in the Bethel area?
Hi, Tony. It's hard to tell because it's hard to understand what tribalism means in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan. It sounds on the face of it like it might mean a similar thing to what it means for us, you know, like sort of loose affiliations of, village groups and clans and families and everything. But I would really hesitate to think that I understood that about Afghanistan, for instance, or about Iraq, because it's those groupings, for instance, always had a military component. You know, in Afghanistan, it was regional warlords and bandits and things like that, and that was true in Iraq, too. You know, they had their own, they were like armies, you know, so tribalism in Alaska obviously doesn't have that component. So there's not quite the power dynamics and everything. So that's why I'd be really hesitant to compare them or imagine that I could understand one in relation to the other. I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Could you comment if NPR reporters or journalists are received differently than reporters from other news outlets like Fox or CNN or stuff like that?
Yeah. in the American military in Afghanistan, they like Fox a lot better than they do NPR. But it's amazing. I run into a lot of people who are, in the military, for instance, that are American officers and enlisted men who listen to NPR. Okay. So, but in general terms, they like Fox better. If you're talking about people from the country, and people in the governing structures and stuff like that, very often if they've had experience in the U.S., all they know is NPR. Because they listen to it in taxi cabs and things like that. So very often you get recognized much more often than the person from Fox would. And I've had people, especially they think of us in relation to BBC, so they'll slap you on the shoulder and say, "Ah, Detroit! Detroit, just like BBC."
Corey, thank you so much. I have the unfortunate duty of calling this to an end.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Corey Flintoff, foreign correspondent for NPR and former host of Alaska News Nightly. Corey joined APRN's Lori Townsend for an onstage conversation at the Anchorage Museum as part of the APRN Speaker Series on May 24th. He then responded to questions from the audience, which you can hear on our website at alaskapublic.org. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.